stumbled onto, and then I thought, well, that would make an interesting study. I was reading on something in the Old Testament and came across in Habakkuk chapter 1 and verse 11 where it talked about the Chaldean soldiers and Chaldean army and their view of themselves. It says who viewed their own strength as God. In other words, they thought of their ability in such a way that it elevated them. They thought of that as being like God. And it hit me, there are a number of examples of this type of thing in the Bible, where people serve some type of God, but they are basically the gods of men. And so I want us to take a look at some different things. I think probably the first thing we think of when we think of a little g god, that is a non-god. The Bible affirms that there is one God, and that all other types of gods or forms of gods are not real. Paul, even in 1 Corinthians 12 and verse 2, told the Corinthians that in the past, they as Gentiles, as pagans, some versions have that, were led away to these dumb idols. He said dumb because the word means to be mute, that is, they can't speak. All through the Old Testament, you see references to idol gods as being unable to hear, unable to speak, unable to reason, unable to act. They are non-gods. But the word God is used in these places because of perceptions that people had of them. And in the course of human history, I say here both biblical and secular history, you see all kinds of concepts, all sorts of views of God. But if you're thinking of idolatry, and I think that is the first place we go for thinking of some non-God, non-unreal God, then we think of idolatry. But actually, in the Bible, if you start and go chronologically and do a study of this, the first non-God, the first anti-God, was man. And so it's rather interesting. You see it in Genesis chapter 3 when the devil tempted Eve. How did he get her to eat the fruit of the forbidden tree? He said, "You shall be as gods. You shall be as gods." And so people were suggested to be able to be God. And then this is what you see when you begin to do a study of corrupt government, and typically of human government in general. Which is rather interesting because it seems like many human governments view themselves sort of godlike, as all-powerful, as having the power to be the determinant in deciding what you do, what your freedoms are, what we're going to allow you to do, and what we deem to be good and what we deem to be evil. That tendency has been with man through the course of human history. It's pretty remarkable. We'll see many examples on that. When it comes, though, to God, the concept of God, the Bible defines God. And we can look at many passages, and that's not my purpose in this study, to look at the nature of the true God, the true and living God. But I'll remind you of one passage that basically summarizes it over in Acts chapter 17. Acts 17, Paul is preaching in Athens at Mars Hill, and we often reference that statement about the people in Athens. They were interested in doing nothing else but either hearing or telling some new thing, so they were philosophers. Derek referenced this morning in class. They were interested in all kinds of odd information and odd ideas. And so Paul begins his preaching here, and he talks about the nature of God in verse 24. He says, God that made the world and all the things therein. Now, right off the bat, you're going to see quite a difference between that God, the God Paul is talking about, and the human concepts of God. He had just said, the observation had just been made in verse 22, that the people of Athens were very superstitious, very religious. The place was wholly given to idolatry, verse 16 of chapter 17. That observation had already been made. So this was a very idolatrous culture. And Paul, in the midst of that, says, now, God that made the world, not these idols of stone and wood that you have formed. God that made the world. What do you think of if you think of a being capable of making the universe? Well, you're going to think what? Intelligence? You're going to think extreme power, infinite power, power that we can't imagine. Power to manipulate matter. Power first to create matter. Matter has to be created, the substance of which all things is made. And then you have to be able to manipulate that, turning it into whatever you want to. So that's who the God of the Bible is. And he said he's Lord of heaven and earth, and he does not dwell in temples made with hands. You cannot represent him by, as he describes later in verse 29, art and man's device. He cannot be fashioned out of gold or silver or stone. Same verse, verse 29. So Paul describes the true God. What does he mean when he says he dwells not in temples made with hands? He transcends the universe. He doesn't live on it or in it in that sense. He's not a physical being. He cannot be replicated by physical matter. He can't even be he can't even be in any way depicted that way or thought of that way. So Paul preaches a different God than what they thought of. And over in Galatians chapter 4 and verse 8, Paul reminds us that a thing cannot be called God if it does not possess the nature of God. If it does not possess the attributes of God. If it doesn't possess the character of God. All of those things are essential in order for God to be God. The nature of God. Formerly, when you knew, did not know God, you were slaves to those who by nature are not gods. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 8 and verse 4 that an idol is nothing in the world. Nothing at all in the world. So it's not real. It's not real. So we're going to be talking about some of these little g gods that have been a problem through the course of human history. First one I want to talk about is the God of government. This was the first area where people thought, ah, this must be God. It's amazing how many times in history you see people who were political, civil leaders who claimed to be God. I have a lengthy list of those. Who claimed to be God. And then there are others who had deity attributed to them. They didn't claim it. You know, for example, all of the line, what we call the Julius Caesar line of emperors of Rome, all of them claimed to be God except Claudius. You know, you read about Claudius in the book of Acts. He did not personally claim to be God. Caligula did, Augustus did, Tiberius did, Nero did. All the others did, Vespasian did, but Claudius didn't. But later they built monuments to him, deifying him. The people did that. So it seems to be either someone, some leader claimed to be God, or others attributed Godhead to him. Why is that? What is that tendency? Well, people today have a government God mentality. They really do. They think that government gives us our rights and gives us our liberties and authorizes us either to open our church buildings up for worship or not. Think back just 3 years ago. And they think they have that right. People tend to think that government has that right. Well, this was a big problem in human history. For example, you don't get very far. Well, let me remind you of 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 3. Paul says, let no one deceive you in any way, for that day will not come. He's talking about the coming of Christ, unless the rebellion comes first or falling away, O King James. And the man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of destruction who opposes and exalts himself against every so-called God or object of worship so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, proclaiming himself to be God. There's a running debate about whether or not that's talking about the first Catholic Pope, which would be 500 some odd years later. I just don't see how that's what Paul's talking about. Or something contemporary in the time of Paul, like, for example, Nero, which is my personal view on this passage. But regardless of who you apply it to, the principle applies to whomever. It applies to whoever takes this attitude, holds this attitude towards himself and towards the concept of God. But if you go back in history, you see some examples of this. For example, the Egyptian pharaohs, that is, the kings of Egypt, all thought of themselves as being God by virtue of their birth. By virtue of their mere birth, they thought of themselves as being God. Alexander the Great was deified. This was on the basis of one of his parents being traced back to the line of Egyptian kings and his status then as God, as leader. The Seleucid kings, the Ptolemy kings, all believed themselves to be divine. Antiochus Epiphanes certainly made these claims frequently. He claimed himself to be God. And as I said, the Roman emperors, at least the early ones, the ones that could trace their lineage back to Julius Caesar, so the beginning, the Augustus, the beginning of the Roman Empire, they all believed themselves to be God. So this has been a common problem. Shintos believe that their dead relatives are God. And that's the basis of their worship, that is the main Japanese religion. So it is a God that is not true God, not the God of heaven and earth. You begin to see this in the Bible back in Genesis 10. It's interesting that before you read about idolatry, before you read about idol gods, you read about men gods, human gods. That is, they saw themselves that way. For example, we read about Nimrod. Nimrod was described as being a mighty hunter before the Lord in Genesis chapter 9. Interesting thing about that, and there's been a running debate about this. Some think that here God is looking from heaven since it says before the Lord. And he just saw this unique character, Nimrod, that he was very skilled at hunting. Like he was just a good hunter. He killed a lot of animals. That's not the context of this, and that's not what the verse means either. It's not talking about hunting deer or turkey. It's not talking about that at all. This is the context has to do with a man who was building a kingdom. That's what you read here in Genesis chapter 10. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, Akkad, Calna, in the land of Shinar. Some of you may be experiencing a little deja vu. Didn't Isaac just read in Genesis 11 and those two places were mentioned? Babel, yes. How is it called Babel? How is it first named Babel in Genesis 11 when it's mentioned in Genesis chapter 10? Well, because Genesis 11 takes place, it's going back describing what happened back here in Genesis chapter 10. When Nimrod is establishing this power, trying to establish a world empire. It had a beginning at Babel. Many believe that to be Babylon. And then in these other cities, and it spread. And he was looking to do what? Well, before we can really appreciate that, what does the word Nimrod mean? We know how it's used today. That guy's a real Nimrod. If you call somebody a Nimrod today, you might do that. You know, this passage is, right here in Genesis 10, is the one that talks about people calling other people Nimrod. It says that in verse 9 of Genesis chapter 10. Just a little reminder here. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. So you might do that. He's a Nimrod. But when you say that, are you meaning that he's an imbecile? That he's foolish or dumb? No, you would be saying he's a rebel. That's what the word Nimrod means. A rebel. It means to revolt. That's the meaning of Nimrod. So he's trying to establish this huge kingdom. We know by just mere association of terms from chapter 11, Babel, land of Shinar, plain of Shinar, and that's the context here in Genesis chapter 10 as well, that it's talking about the same thing. You're not hundreds of years later with some other people. This was Nimrod. Nimrod wanting to build the temple that reached, what was he trying to glorify? Trying to glorify men, trying to glorify himself. That's what he was doing, just like Nebuchadnezzar, almost identical to what Nebuchadnezzar did later. What about the word before the Lord? This would be kind of a strange verse in Genesis chapter 10 and verse 9, where it says he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. If this just means that, you know, this is just like in the presence of the Lord, or this is the one that God saw, what about all of the other millions of people on the planet? Did he not see them? Were they not before him? Was it just Nimrod that was before him? The word before doesn't mean in the sense of, doesn't mean God just being able to see him. The word means before in the sense of above. It means against. It means in the face of. Kyle and Dalich have a great explanation in this in the Old Testament commentary they do. And they describe all of this. And you put this together, it makes perfect sense what happened with Nimrod. Nimrod wanted to rule the world. He was a mighty hunter, but not a hunter of animals. He was a hunter of men. He was a hunter of men and a controller of men. And he's building this worldwide kingdom. And it came to naught because God, of course, confused the languages, and that made people not be able to work together to be able to facilitate all of this. But now it was in the face. The word means in the face of the Lord, or you might say against the Lord. He was a mighty hunter against the Lord, before, in place of the Lord. Not just that God could see. So as I said, you had in chapter 11 the story of that goes back in time and talks about it, plugs in, because this is a genealogy in chapter 10. So it was more reasonable for a story of some particular event like the Tower of Babel to be described later and be plugged in later. And that's exactly what the Bible does here. Nebuchadnezzar did exactly the same thing. This mentality is common among civil political leaders. Nebuchadnezzar claimed in Daniel chapter 4 and verse 30, is not this great Babylon that I built for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power and for the honor of my majesty? How did he really view himself? You know, it's funny how the Bible is its own commentary. Its own best commentary. In Isaiah 14, you know, throughout the book of Isaiah, God through Isaiah pronounces judgments upon nations. One of the nations that God was going to bring to nothing was Babylon. Babylon, the great city, the great kingdom. And so, in the pronouncement of judgment against Babylon, in Isaiah 14 and verse 14, it says, I will ascend above the heights and the clouds, I will be like the Most High. Who is he speaking of here? The king of Babylon. How did he view himself? The king of Babylon said, I will be like the Most High. So when you're reading back in Daniel chapter 4 and verse 30, we have a little commentary on this now. When you're reading that, and he says, you know, is this not by my power and my honor and my majesty? He's claiming to be divine. He's claiming to be all-powerful. And a man might reach a conclusion like that when he's subjugated the entire known world. You might be inclined to estimate yourself that way. But there's a little problem. If you think of yourself as being God, just because you're a great and powerful, mighty political leader or civil leader or king or ruler or tyrant, you've left out something. You've left out the meaning of the word God. And that's exactly what Nebuchadnezzar did. You may remember what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. If you go on reading in Daniel chapter 4, he was diminished. He was tremendously reduced in his stature. In fact, he was so afflicted by God that he went about walking like an animal and eating grass for his sustenance, like a donkey. He's compared to a donkey. So here's a man who had a high estimation of himself and ended up being like a donkey. Until he came to the realization, until he knew what? That God, oh, the other God, the real God, rules in the kingdoms of men and sets over them whomsoever he will. He had to learn that lesson, as we say, the hard way. But that was Nebuchadnezzar. He was greatly reduced. Belshazzar made exactly the same mistake. You may read the idea of Nebuchadnezzar being the father, more than likely the grandfather, because there was the son Nabopolassar who had taken over the kingdom. And so most believe that Belshazzar was actually the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. But he made exactly the same mistake. In Daniel chapter 5, let's go ahead and read that before I move on here. Daniel chapter 5, look at verses 22 and 23. You remember that Belshazzar had decided to have a big party. And he brought out all of the vessels of gold and the utensils that they had confiscated from the destruction of Jerusalem, when they invaded Jerusalem and took and sacked the city and tore down the city walls and destroyed the temple. And they carried off all of the valuables from there. So here they have them in the palace in Babylon. And Belshazzar says, hey, bring this stuff out. But Daniel says to him, you, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this. I always thought that was interesting. So they had some history. He had some training. He would have known about the origin of these things. He would have known about the story. He said, though you knew this, but you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven, and the vessels of his house have been brought in before you. You and your lords, your wives, and your concubines have drunk wine from them, and you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze and iron, wood and stone, which you do not see or hear or know, but the God in whose hand is your breath, and whose are all your ways you have not honored. So he had a rather high estimation of himself. But he ignored God. By the way, how does that story end? How does Belshazzar's story end? After he's so elevated himself and his view of himself. Meeny, meeny, tekel, upharsin. That's how it ends. You've been weighed in the scale. God has numbered the days of your kingdom. You've been weighed in the balances and are found wanting. Your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. That's how that ended. And he was brought to naught. This is always how this ends. Over in Ezekiel chapter 28 and verse 2. Ezekiel writes, Son of man, or God writes to, God speaks to Ezekiel and tells him to say this in judgment against the king of Tyre. Say this, because your heart is proud and you have said, I am a God. I sit in the seat of the gods, in the heart of the seas, yet you are but a man and no God. Though you make your heart like the heart of a god. King of Tyre, little city-state over there, on the shore, the Mediterranean, made himself a god. It was common for leaders of those times to so view themselves. The Bible teaches that we need to be very careful about how we define and view government. We need to be very careful. Many people wind up in trouble because of their views of government. They relinquish their rights, their freedoms. They begin to even interpret the Bible. I became very aware of this in 2020. I was a little bit shaken, a little bit disturbed by how all of a sudden we have a new hermeneutic. You know those lessons, sermons that preachers preach on hermeneutics? I have one. I wrote a book on it. I think a class book that we use downstairs on hermeneutics and figures of speech and all of those types of things and using the Bible to interpret the Bible. And all of a sudden we have a new hermeneutic. We have to all of a sudden, and I ran into this, by the way, now this is interesting. I hadn't thought about this in a while. I ran into exactly the same thing over that marriage issue that got me in heap big trouble. When I said that Matthew 19:9 guarantees an innocent spouse, it is a God-given liberty that an innocent spouse whose mate has committed fornication has the right to take action against the fornicator. Even if the fornicator has already beat them to the lawyer, beat them to the courthouse, beat them to whatever action, as one brother said, slamming the door. He said, well, if he slams the door. And I said, you're telling me that if the fornicator slams the door on the innocent spouse is now put away, cannot avail himself or herself of the God-given liberty? He said, yes. A gospel preacher said it right over here in debate, right here in Bowling Green years ago. Now, I want you to think about what they've done there. They've allowed government, maybe the pronouncements of a judge, a civil judge somewhere, to completely circumvent what the Bible expressly states in Matthew 19:9. It's really unbelievable. And on COVID, it was remarkable what people came up with. Passages were viewed in new and different ways that they'd never been viewed in before. Something totally different. Well, let's be reminded when it comes to government, we don't look to government for our liberties and our rights. We look to God. That's where we go for those things, for our freedoms. A lot of people have been caught up in this idea of citing the Constitution. We have the Constitution. The Constitution could be completely nullified if enough legislators decide to do it and enough states decide to do it. It could be completely nullified. That could happen in an amazingly short period of time. Look at some things that are being done right now today by our government. Just this week. Some things you think, I would have never thought that was going to happen. Well, it did. It did. They did happen. It can happen very quickly. David said it's better. And thanks, Josh. Josh, the next one coming up is one that Josh comes from. I said, I had this verse in my head and I kept thinking Proverbs. And it wasn't in Proverbs, it's in Psalm. But in Psalm 118, first, verses 8 and 9, David said, it is better to take refuge in the Lord than to trust in a man. It is better to take refuge in the Lord than to trust in princes. What does he mean by princes? He means civil rulers. But that's exactly what people do, parallel to it. Later in Psalm 146, in verses 3 and 4, put not your trust in princes, in a son of man, in whom there is no, when he means they're a mere man, not Christ, in whom there is no salvation. When his breath departs, he returns to the earth. On that very day, his plans perish. Any plans and intentions he had, things that he wanted to accomplish on this earth, when he dies, it's done. By the way, that's true of every civil leader. And the reason it's true of every civil leader, whether he be a king, a president, a tyrant, or whatever, dictator, is because it's true of every human being. It's true of everyone. That's why it's true of the princes as well. We need to be very careful about that. How should we view civil leaders? As gods? They often like to view themselves that way. Paul said, no, they're quite the opposite of gods. They're not gods. They may consider themselves to be some type of god. They may consider themselves to be divine, the Roman emperors, the pharaohs, the king of Tyre or Nimrod, but they're not. They're quite the opposite. They are actually servants. Romans 13:4 says, for he is the minister, the servant of God, to thee for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid, for he bears not the sword in vain, for he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon he that doeth evil. By the way, these verses 3 and 4 here, as I've talked about a lot over the years, define the role of government. The purpose, the role of government, to punish those who do what is evil, and to praise or reward those who do what is right. So government, God has legislated on this. I don't view government as God. God is God. Government is a servant of God. And it should remember its place. Government must remember its place. And too often it seems as though, if you look at human history, that appears to be almost impossible. If you go back to 1 Samuel chapter 8, what did the people say? We want a king. Why? Verse 5. To be like the nations around us. And what did God describe when he then said, okay, Samuel, give them a king? He described several different levels of punishment that would happen to the people because of their having a king. Civil government, civil leaders were given as a punishment by God in 1 Samuel chapter 8. We ought to remember that type of thing. And most people would be shocked to think that that's what the Bible teaches about that. But no, we serve the Lord Christ. We don't serve government. And sadly, government, it gets imposed upon us. Looking at the clock here, let me see how much time I have. 30 minutes. I've got about 5 more, don't I? One more, we may not get to finish this, but I think for the most part, people who they're not political and they're not certainly not elected leaders or appointed leaders of some caliber, and so they wouldn't think of any of the passages we've studied so far applying to themselves. But there is a sense in which too many people do view themselves as God. And this goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 3 and humanism. You ever think about Genesis 3 being the origin of humanism? We think of humanism as being like a 20th century American doctrine, which is still affecting us all the way up to today. But really, humanism started a long time ago. Humanism is the idea that really we don't need God for morals and ethics. We don't need religion. It's not God-based. It's not religion-based. It's self-based. We should be able to reason ourselves what is right and what is wrong. How many people do you know who believe that, think that way? Too many. Too many do. And some people will claim to be religious, but are still actually humanistic in their approach to morals and ethics. You know why I say that? Because here's what you hear. Well, I know the Bible says that, but you know, the Bible's kind of old and things have changed a lot. They're still humanists walking about claiming to be Christians. Socrates had this idea. You've studied history and you know about Socrates and his famous expression, know yourself, know thyself. What was the context of Socrates saying, know yourself? Well, it was in the context of moral behavior, moral conduct. He wasn't just encouraging people to really think about who they are, maybe what they want to do for a living or something, you know. No, he's talking about morality. It had to do with morality by reasoning. That was Socrates. He popularized that idea in his day. Aristotle really picked up on this and taught the doctrine of rationalism, which is still very popular today. Rationalism is basically humanism. Rationalism is the idea that we should be able to reason our way in any situation, determining what is right or wrong. This has led to situation ethicism, ethics, situation ethics, and all of that. Back in the 3rd century, though, it was eudaimonism, I think so you say that, which is this view. By the way, Epicurus got involved in this, and the Epicureans were involved in it. So what do you think of when you think of that? Well, that really it's all about what makes you happy. Have you heard anything like that today? Whatever feels good. If it feels good, do it. That's the mantra of so too many in our modern culture today. Where did this come from? Well, you might say, well, it came from Aristotle, rationalism. It actually, and by the way, they threw in with pleasure, you know, a good life through pleasure. They said, well, it could happen through wealth. You could really accomplish your goals through wealth. Or you might do that through honor, like you might be elevated and be popular. And so it could be through personal honor. But either way, you know, whatever makes you feel good, then that's what it's all about. But where did this come from? It didn't come from the 3rd century A.D. It came from the Garden of Eden. It didn't come from God. It came from the devil. This is exactly the appeal the devil made. The devil was the first humanist, the first rationalist. God does know that in the day that you eat that fruit, your eyes will be open, and you shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. That's the sense in which many people, though they will admit it or not, view themselves as God. Anytime you start taking a position that says, you know what, I don't need the Bible to tell me or religion to tell me what is right from wrong, I think I can figure, I'm a smart guy or I'm a smart gal, I can figure that out on my own. It just seems like, we start going down the path of Proverbs 16, it seems like there's a way that seems, or 1425 or 1412 Proverbs, there is a way that seems right to a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. That's where it goes. I should be able to figure that out. And so the devil actually instigated that, but I have some more to say on that, and out of time, so I need to quit this morning. We always want to provide an opportunity for anyone present in an assembly who is either not a child of God or who is a child of God who has fallen, to make correction, that all-important correction. As I always say, reach a point in our lives. We don't know when that is. That's the fascinating thing about this. It could be today, and we just don't know it. It could be some years from now, but when the only thing that will matter is whether or not we're right with God, that will be the only thing that matters. I say it could happen today. Did you see the news last night? Just tragic. These people were having a birthday party. Birthday party. And some drunk driver slammed through a gathering of children and parents. Killed two of them. Injured 16. I think there are five of them. Some adults and some children who are in critical condition right now. Which means someone else or more may not make it. From someone leaving the road and driving through a party, birthday party, where they're celebrating someone's birthday. You ever been at a birthday party? This can happen anytime. Weird, unpredictable things. They happen every day. And it reminds us of the brevity of life and the frailty of man. Alexander thought he was God. It's commonly believed that Alexander died as a result of a mosquito bite. Some say he was poisoned. Some say he was bitten by a mosquito, got malaria, and was poisoned later. We don't know all the facts on that. But people do die from malaria. Millions of people die from malaria every year. Or I should say hundreds of thousands. I think it's about a million. It's unbelievable. From a mosquito bite. Do we think that way? Does that register? We need to be ready. We need to be ready spiritually. This morning, if you're not a Christian, you can become one by simply doing what the Bible calls putting on Christ. Through faith and repentance and confession and baptism. Or, if you are a child of God but have fallen and want restoration, you want to be renewed in your faith, you want to be forgiven, you can ask God yourself to forgive you. Or you can do like Simon did, who asked Peter, would you pray for me? And we'll, as brothers one another, we'll be more than happy to do that. So if you're subject to the invitation in either way, come forward as we stand and sing. Softly and tenderly.